Wednesday, December 9th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. Arianna Huffington says she's no longer entertained. Donald Trump's crossed the line, and it's time to stop covering his campaign as an entertainment story. Sinclair owns dozens of TV stations across the country. Well, now it looks like it's expanding its digital portfolio as well, announcing plans to bring the once popular news app Circa back from the dead. And the Radio Television Digital News Foundation awards its first ever First Amendment Defender Award to someone here at the Missouri School of Journalism. There's a lot more that we're going to hopefully get to as well before our half hour is up, but let's start with the mass shooting in San Bernardino and the media's response to it. 14 people died last Wednesday after Syed Farouk and his wife, Tashfeen Malik, opened fire during an event at a holiday party. This incident was the deadliest since Sandy Hook, and the fact that the shooters were Muslims from Pakistan, well, the media adopted a mob mentality that can only be described as shameful. On Friday, the couple's landlord opened their townhouse and the media swarmed the two-bedroom unit in what looked almost like the opening of a Best Buy on Black Friday. Reporters and photographers everywhere fighting for position and wanting to be the first to find some nugget of something. And the cable networks, they broadcast the whole thing live. Among the most aggressive in its coverage, MSNBC. Here's Carrie Sanders inside the couple's bathroom looking through family photographs.
Carrie, as you go through some of these pictures, we would have to still try to identify who this woman is, but we have not yet seen a picture.
Absolutely.
No one has seen
Absolutely.
A picture of Syed Farouk's wife.
Right. We don't have a picture that basically has them together. Yeah, this is clearly a birthday party that was taking place with the cake and the smiles, and it looks like somebody's ninth birthday party there.
Let's make sure we don't.
Okay, here's the
let's make sure we don't see the children. Let's not show the child.
NBC News and Carrie Sanders have since issued apologies and said that they realized they went over the line. CNN went live from inside the apartment as well, but the reporter was a bit more restrained with what she showed and what she said on air. Still, the shock in Anderson Cooper's voice and on his face is palpable.
I want to bring in our Harry Houck, a law enforcement analyst, formerly with the NYPD. Harry, it just strikes me as bizarre what we're seeing. Is this
Anderson.
Common? I mean, I guess at some point the police give up the crime scene and somebody else takes it over.
Anderson, I'm having chills down my spine what I'm seeing here. This apartment clearly is full of evidence.
So we got several tweets from listeners to our program who said they couldn't wait to hear our take on this. So let me just put it as simply as possible. What's your take?
I mean, overall, it's just pathetic. It's inexcusable. Does that mean that journalists there was no journalistic value in going into that apartment under some circumstance or another? I could argue how there could be value, although I might come back to that. But doing this live, having this herd mentality, picking up photos, showing children, showing the mother.
Leafing through them one at a time and narrating it.
I mean, basically, what value was being conveyed there? I mean, what it really says to me is it was either directly or indirectly reinforcing a stereotype. Well, hey, here's this Muslim couple living in this, townhouse, and any Muslim couple could have, arms and ammunition and bombs in there. It's feeding a narrative that it didn't need to feed, and it's only there for competitive reasons. If the first media through the door hadn't gone through, none of the rest of them probably would. They would have felt so shameful about what they were doing that they might have withheld. But it's kind of the classic prisoner's dilemma, do I go or don't I go? If we all stuck together and stood by our own ethical principles, maybe we'd all be better off, but nobody's going to calculate it that way.
Well, to me, it goes back to that sort of the mob mentality that you're talking about, but it's exacerbated because you want to go in and you want to do it and you want to get the ratings and you want to be the first on scene. You want to get the scoop, but how do you get a scoop in journalistic terms? How do you get a scoop when everyone's there?
When you're in a scrum.
And to me, it violates a lot of ethical principles, and Mike has heard me say this a lot. Just because you have the ability to go live doesn't mean that you should. You need to sort of stop and pull back and go, okay, what value are we going to get from this?
At the very least, you need to have the time to see what's there, to see what's correct in capturing, put that in some kind of context.
Right? I knew the word context was coming.
But also, I think you have part of it too, Ernest, in that, you know, there's sort of become this, depressingly, this playbook, as some journalists are talking about. We have enough of these that we cover them the same way every time. Oh, here's something novel. When do cops or anybody ever let us into a crime scene? So here we go. Right.
That was the thing that surprised me more than anything else, was the fact that they were allowed to go in there. Usually, they aren't allowed to go in there until weeks, days, even if at all, to look at a crime scene like that. The fact that there were no police officers there to go, whoa, wait a minute, this is still an active crime scene. And not only the police investigators, but you had the FBI, you had federal prosecutors who were probably wanting to go in there. You probably had state officials who wanted to go in there. And for the press to be allowed in there, that was a surprising part to me. And here's the other part to it. Now that we've done this, now that the media has done this, you bet believe that that they are never going to be allowed to do anything like this again at all.
Perhaps the news organizations themselves won't be, but here's what I worry about. Landlord saw what kind, well, at first saw what kind of friends he was making with the media and a little bit of fame he got. Afterwards, he backed off. Oh, I really was just kind of opening the door, and they rushed in, whatever that means. But what's going to stop the landlord next time from just himself or inviting a friend in with a cell phone and recording the same stuff and then selling it to the highest bidder or putting it out on social media? And we'll be right back where we were in the videos of the shootings in South Carolina. You know, do we put that on the air? We didn't take it, but it's already out there in the public domain. So I guess we have to.
I mean, to me, it just it's sort of creating this atmosphere of everything is fair game. And it lacks context. It lacks ethical standards. It lacks, to me, just human decency. I mean, you're showing these pictures of, yes, they're family members and, yes, they're friends, but are we going to sort of guilt by association?
In the whole
exactly.
Process.
I mean,
interestingly enough, when I was asked about this Friday and saw the tweets coming in and managing our accounts, I was drawn to going back to read The Journalist's Creed, written by Walter Williams. And the final paragraph or stanza of that reads, "I believe that the journalism which succeeds best and best deserves success fears God and honors man." And this is the part that was that stood out the most to me. "It is stoutly independent, unmoved by pride of opinion or greed of power, constructive, tolerant, but never careless, self-controlled, patient, always respectful of its readers, but always unafraid, is quickly indignant at injustice and is unswayed by the appeal of privilege or the clamor of the mob, and seeks to give every man a chance and, as far as law and honest wage and recognition of human brotherhood can make it, to do so an equal chance." To me, it just it felt like this directly violated that. It moved in the mob mentality, not only the scrum moving into the apartment in that mob, but the idea of the innocents that were involved here and creating the voyeuristic look at here's what's going on in a Muslim household.
I mean, I think that there are individual journalists in these news organizations, including the cable news networks, that would say they uphold some version of that creed or would like to. There are even news organizations as a group, which in a vacuum say we believe in these kinds of principles. But you put that up against the frenzy for ratings, the social media-fueled 24-hour news cycle.
The paparazzi mentality.
I mean, and if you think about it, when has any outrage like this had any long-lasting impact on any individual newsroom? They're going to say,
oh, it hasn't. If anything, it's almost created a new standard of what might be acceptable. And I think that's my fear on some levels, that perhaps this might become a new normal.
And that's the legitimate fear, because part of it is that you can see them as the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're not a part of us. We're covering them as the other. And so as you continue to create this narrative that Mike was talking about, what's going to keep the press, or what's going to keep the media from trying to infringe upon those privacy rights when someone is actually living there? I mean, they were gone. Okay, they're dead and they're gone and this is their apartment. But what is the next step? Is the next step we're going to be allowed to go in even though they're still alive and capable of possibly coming back to their home?
Should we have allowed the media into the home of the mother of the Sandy Hook shooter? I mean, even though she was still alive and her home was there, the Colorado theater shooter?
Or the family of the Charleston shooter.
Right.
Yeah.
And frankly, I mean, although most of this rests on the media, the reason I raise the point about ratings is indirectly to say that, you know, there's an awful lot of us out there who have these voyeuristic rubbernecking tendencies, and we may say that this is disgusting, shocking, horrible, but we watch it.
Well, yeah, that's
with
right.
Each of these mass shootings, we talk about the news coverage and how it always seems to happen in the same ways and that nothing is going to change until Congress decides to act and take on the gun lobby. Well, maybe we have a listener of this program at the New York Daily News. Thursday, the tabloids cover, it was a collection of tweets from Republican presidential candidates offering thoughts and prayers with the headline, God isn't fixing this. And for the first time since 1920, the New York Times ran a front page editorial on Saturday calling it a moral outrage and national disgrace, the ease with which civilians can legally buy weapons designed to kill with speed and efficiency. We're starting to see this with a lot of papers. In fact, the Daily News cover today shows Donald Trump literally slashing the head off of the Statue of Liberty. Are we seeing more bold coverage in print than perhaps we have in the past?
I was really surprised Sunday morning when I opened up my New York mm-hmm. Times and I'm sitting there with my cup of coffee, and the first thing I see was the editorial, and I turned to my wife and I said, this is new.
Mm-hmm.
And being a historian, I said, I don't think the Times has done this in
1920.
A very long time. And then I read where they had 1920 was the last time they did it. And for the New York Times, which clearly is seen as a national newspaper, to come out with a front page editorial about this raises the stakes. So now everyone is actually talking about this in the context of now's the time to really start looking at, what are we going to do about our gun laws? Are we going to do anything? Is the influence of the National Rifle Association too big? That conversation is now taking place, and the media as a whole, some seem to be shifting toward, we need to take a more aggressive approach in leading that discussion or moving that discussion. Where that's going to go, I have no idea, but I think we are now on that trajectory.
I mean, we've been talking for a long time about kind of the blurring between opinion and, quote, straight news coverage, and how a lot of, at least, you know, digital first news organizations don't fret about this kind of stuff. I find the New York Times thing really interesting to me because, on one level, okay, it's a historical first, mm-hmm. at least in this century. It's been, what, almost 90 years or whatever since they did it last time. Does an editorial on the front page of a printed newspaper or make any difference today? I don't know if front pages generally make any difference, except as it gets shared by social media or as it becomes part of a sort of a savvy PR campaign that we're doing this for the first time because we think it's important. Then you get the buzz about it. But just being on the front page of the paper probably doesn't make that much difference.
Well, I would say that one of the things that it did was that it got other media to think about it. It got other media to sort of begin to look at the issue, and then that creates the sort of buzz and the momentum that you were talking about. And I think there are very few news operations that can have that kind of an influence, and I think the New York Times is one of them.
I mean, I kind of wonder if maybe they decided to finally do this because the added element of domestic terrorism, you know, somehow change the calculation or would get more people to think twice about gun laws. Or I don't think ultimately it will. I hate to say that. But, you know, there have been a lot of mass shootings, and this is the first time they chose to do this. Maybe the confluence of terrorism and these mass shootings played a part in
that. And I think that had a lot to do with it. I mean, if you stop and think about it, you're right. There have been a lot of mass shootings, but now we're talking about this on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
I mean, usually there was
350 some odd by the time this happened.
Well, I think we got to talk about that because the media are at least portraying the fact that there are so many more of these. And if you look at some of the press coverage, I mean, the Washington Post had this infographic that shows the calendar for the year, and 350 some in less than a year. But their definition was based on something that a pro-gun control group on Reddit used, which counts people who were injured as well as killed. If you look at, oh, say, Cliff Van Zandt, the guy that shows up on MSNBC mm-hmm. all the time whenever there's a crime, he's saying, I just can't even remember these shootings anymore. There's so many of them. But there's a in a Seattle Times article, which I found really interesting, they quote a scientist from Northeastern University who's a criminology professor. And he says, in truth, if you look back over time, there aren't that many more. What he said is that the only increase has been in fear, in our perception that there's right. been an increase, and it's all been fueled by the media. I don't know that he's right about that, but it's an interesting conversation. Well, I'll just jump to the fact that, though, there's 355 of them.
I agree. I think that is an interesting conversation. I think that there's a bit of both to it. I think the media coverage has definitely been ramped up. But I also think the way in which these shootings are happening, the randomness of them, and they're happening on a weekly basis is part of what's happening here in that sort of fear. I mean, when you go back to Paris, the fact that you could be innocently having a cup of coffee and then all of a sudden find yourself in a mass shooting, I think that is what's sort of driving a lot of this.
I'm going to sound really old school when I say this, but I want to go back to the New York Daily News for yeah. a second, because they didn't get as much attention as the Times did. The Times labeled it as an editorial on the front page, mm-hmm. okay? The New York Daily News ran it as their entire cover for Republican presidential candidates, and when the editor-in-chief of the paper, the guy who's in charge of the journalism, not the mm-hmm. editorials, a guy named Jim Rich, was asked about it. He basically said, you know, we're just trying to figure out some way to do this differently. And then he was asked, well, why only Republican presidential candidates? Why not some Democrats who also ask for prayers and support, you know, gun rights? And he says, well, they're only the only ones, the Republicans, offering empty platitudes. I don't think that a person in charge of the news should be saying that. What he feels is one thing. How it influences the coverage is another thing. I don't think it's right for the editor-in-chief to be saying that.
No, I agree with you, Mike. But this goes back to this point that you just made a minute ago where you're saying the social media outlets, or a lot of the social media outlets, have been doing this ever since their inception. Now you have some of the legacy media that are doing the same thing. And they're saying, look, you know, we're going to get involved in this sort of blurring of the lines between opinion and editorial and that sort of thing. Now, I don't agree with it. I don't think that's the way we should be doing it. But I'm not surprised by the way it was done.
Well, it should come as no shock that at the center of all of this is Donald Trump doing what he can to make headlines. And if that's by fear-mongering, so be it. Maybe you're sensing my frustration, but that's because it seems to me that banning Muslims from visiting our country simply because they're Muslim, well, that's not who and what we are as a nation. And to think we have a presidential candidate suggesting that boggles my mind. And apparently Arianna Huffington's too. And that, coupled with the lies about Muslims celebrating 9/11, his status as, in her words, the birther-in-chief, his misogyny, xenophobia, and scapegoating of immigrants, and countless instances of bullying. Well, she says it's time the Huffington Post reverse the July decision to cover his campaign as an entertainment story. Again, I'm going to use her words. The HuffPost will not only cover the ways Trump's campaign is unique in recent American politics, but also the disastrous impact it continues to have on the fellow candidates in the race and the national conversation. The three of us have kind of had this unspoken rule that we weren't going to give Trump or his campaign attention unless there was some newsworthy reason to do so. And, you know, maybe we've purposely ignored or skirted some of his antics on the program, bringing them up in different ways. I don't know. Your thoughts about Arianna Huffington's decision here?
Well, I think this goes along with what we were just talking yeah. about. I mean, you have a media organization that is basically saying, look, we have to take a stand here. And we're going to cover him as news now and not as entertainment because it's gotten serious. It's gotten real.
It's gotten real. Reading her statement, though, and to read into it, and the full thing is on our links blog, it almost looks like she's going one step further than that and committing to try to take this guy and his candidacy down.
Well, yeah, I think so, too. But I would almost say that of everything that's been written about Trump in the past week or so, what Arianna Huffington has written is probably the least interesting to me. I'll tell you some things that are even more interesting. So you had Ross Douthat, who's the the most conservative sort of intellectual columnist at the New York Times, actually wrote a column last week asking whether or not Trump is a fascist and went through sort of the classic political science definition and said there are many of these characteristics where he seems to match up, or at the very least, he's a demagogue. There was an interesting interview on Morning Edition today, which basically asked an expert the same kind of thing. Is Donald Trump a demagogue? And, you know, I think the bottom line is a lot of media, just like a lot of pundits, like a lot of people in the party establishment, really didn't take Trump seriously. And every time they thought, well, finally, he's going to go over the edge and he's going to cause irreparable damage to his campaign. And as that gets to be less and less likely, the media ratchet up the language they're using to describe it.
Yeah. And I think part of it now is that the Republican Party is not worried about what's going to happen to Donald Trump. They're worried about what's going to happen to our party. I mean, because he is dragging not only, you know, his supporters in one direction, but now you have the other candidates who some of the establishment feel would make better nominees. He's dragging them in that direction. So it's become a huge problem not only for the party, but now you even have conservatism itself questioning whether or not they need to come out and do something to deal with Trump and basically the demagoguery or the fascism or the idiocy of some of the things that he says.
I mean, I think the real fear for the Republicans now is that he's going to run as a third party candidate. They still don't believe in their heart of hearts that he'll win the nomination, though he could, but that he'll run a third party and like Ross Perot, he'll ruin their chances of winning the presidency. But what worries me even more is not even Donald Trump himself, but what is going on in our society right now that so many people resonate with that message. That's what bothers me.
And I think part of it goes back to the fear. When you go back, and this is something I thought was very interesting that the New York Times did on Sunday, where they went out and they actually talked they did a quantitative study, and then they took the study to historians and political scientists, and they came up with actual names. They said he's reminiscent of Goldwater in the 1960s. He's reminiscent of McCarthy in the 50s. He's reminiscent of Huey Long back in the 1930s. So, I mean, it's they're linking him with these demagogues who were able to do exactly what you're talking about, to galvanize a certain segment of the population and bring up their fears and their distrust of others and use it in a way that creates this sort of political maelstrom.
You know, to tie this back to what we were just talking about with regard to guns, I mean, I wonder where the line is for journalists. I mean, BuzzFeed, which has been trying to become more and more of a mainstream news organization, their boss sends out a memo this week basically saying it is okay for the journalists on our news organization to call him a, quote, mendacious racist, if you want to say that, because, quote, it's fact, not opinion. That may be a step too far for me, I think, at least in terms of what is acceptable journalistic practice.
Well, I think part of it, too, is that what we need to do is, as journalists, or what journalists need to do is just basically cover him and say, look, this is right. What he's saying. Here are the reactions to it, and then try to move on from that. But when we give him this cover, it just hurts the whole political atmosphere.
Okay, a couple of other things I want to touch on today, too. Back in June, bite-size news service Circa shut down. It was a mobile app, especially popular with millennials. Now it looks like the Sinclair Broadcast Group is going to revive it. But, Mike, it doesn't look like this is going to look like your little brother's Circa.
Well, I mean, first of all, Circa had not only sort of a technology or an approach, but they also had an attitude, which Sinclair is not going to mimic. Sinclair is a sort of a right-of-center, you know, media company. They even talk about how they see this being an opportunity to go up against BuzzFeed and Vox and Vice by having a centrist or right-of-center approach. So it isn't going to be, you know, your brothers or sisters or your kids' Circa. It won't be.
Okay, something else to talk about. By now, you have seen and heard this video taken November 9th on the Carnahan Quad dozens of times.
Hey, hey, go home! You think it's funny? You need to move.
Go. Hey, I have a job to do. I'm documenting this for national news.
You can go.
Yes, I can.
This is the First Amendment that protects your right to stand here, protects mine.
That's Missouri School of Journalism senior Tim Tai explaining to protesters some of the trickiness of the First Amendment, the balance between freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, and freedom of the press. Well, this week, the Radio Television Digital News Foundation awarded Tim its first ever First Amendment Defenders Award for his actions that day. The accolades keep flowing in here for Tim, and to give our audience a sense sense of some of the other people that RTDNF are honoring this year, others in the cohort? The Washington Post's Jason Rezaian, who remains jailed in Iran, Tom Brokaw, and CBS reporter Cammy McCormick. Those are some pretty big names.
That's some pretty big names. I'm sort of wondering if all the publicity is how Tim is feeling about that, because he really sort of
from the very beginning he didn't want the spotlight on him.
Exactly.
And yet, I mean, the first ever Defender Award. It sounds like a superhero almost, right? But, I mean, I do think he deserves to be recognized for standing up for First Amendment principles and doing it in a principled way. I mean, I think what he did was right, and I think a lot of us have praised him for it. But I suspect you're right. I think it's kind of complicated for him because he didn't seek out this attention. He even said when he was there he didn't want to be the focus of the story, but he's become a focus of the story.
And I think that's going to be part of some of the issues that journalists are talking about, is the fact that, you know, journalists don't want to be part of the story, but then they find themselves in situations like this where they're part of the story, and then to be rewarded for it, so they sort of go, well, wait a minute, that brings even more spotlight on me, which I don't really think is the way in which it should go. But I think journalists should also allow themselves to sort of say, hey, you know, I was doing what I thought was in the best interest of journalism.
Defending the First Amendment and our freedom to do that.
Yes.
We've talked about a lot of serious stuff today. So quickly, before we go, I want to share with you all a little bit of good news. See, usually corrections in newspapers aren't something to cheer about, but today we're happy to report to you that the obituary you may have seen in that Norwegian newspaper, it was a hoax. Santa Claus is not dead, and his funeral will not be held at the North Pole Chapel on December 28th. At 228 years old, we're happy to report he is still alive and well, and the Afton Posten regrets that error. Well, we are just about out of time for today, so I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about. You can find those on our links blog on kbia.org. It's under the programs tab at that site. We also invite you to like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us questions, comments, see what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan and to Maya Jackson for directing today's show and running the audio for us. Sue Lay is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.